Speaker is Dr. Andrew Gonzalez. He's an associate professor in the Department of Biology at McGill, where he also holds a Canada Research Chair in Biodiversity Science. He is the founding director of the Quebec Centre for Biodiversity Science, and one of his major research themes is the influence of habitat fragmentation on biodiversity and ecosystem function, and that is the theme of his talk today.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you to the MSE for organizing this wonderful event. Some amazing talks you've seen today. I want to talk about a theme that's dear to my heart that I've been working on for about 15 years now, and that's habitat loss and habitat fragmentation in particular. And here I'm alluding to a very famous metaphor, Darwin's metaphor, the tangled bank, which was his metaphor for complexity, the wondrous and awe-inspiring complexity that that Darwin observed when he considered nature, whether it was considering it on an island far away in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or whether it's closer to home in his backyard in the southeast of England. And the tangled bank, or the disentangled bank as I'm calling it, because human beings have been trying their very best to simplify, erode, and modify this tangled bank of biodiversity. As we all know, changes in biodiversity due to human activities were more rapid in the past 50 years than at any other time in human history. And last year, 2010, was the International Year for Biodiversity. And we concluded at the end of that year that human beings had not managed to significantly reduce the rate of biodiversity loss. And so we're stuck with this problem that biodiversity loss is accelerating. It's accelerating because we have a number of drivers, the big five drivers, land use, climate change, end deposition, biotic exchange, climate warming, all these factors are working together to erode biodiversity and simplify the tangled bank. That leads to predictions. That leads to predictions at the global scale. Our best estimates are nothing more than back-of-the-envelope calculations about how biodiversity is going to change at the global scale over the next century. So here you see an estimate that's an extinction curve, a global extinction curve for the next century that's just based on estimates of deforestation. And as you can see, we're about to peak at about 50,000 species per million species per decade in the next 50 years, right? And as we look to feed 9 billion people over those 50 years, this curve is probably conservative. And so since the beginning of my career, I've been fascinated by trying to figure out what is the contribution of habitat loss and the contribution of fragmentation to understanding this curve and how it's going to change over the next half century. And it's a bit of a, you know, it's a great message. Well, it's not a great message. It's an important message, but it's misleading because it tells about how biodiversity is changing globally. It's not changing, it's telling us about how biodiversity is changing regionally, where people live. And if anything, biodiversity loss is a pan-regional problem. We have to study it at the regional scale to figure out how it's going to change at the global scale. And what you see here is a map that shows you declines in species abundances, right? Not patterns of extinction, but declines in species abundances globally. And you'll see the hot spots, the red areas represent areas where we now only have 10% of former population levels. Right? So you can see there's a strong correlation to where humans are living, where they're transforming the landscape, changing land use. And we could probably use these data to extrapolate regionally what the extinction rates are going to be over the next century. But I'm going to argue that one way we need to do that is to factor in habitat change, and in particular how patterns of habitat fragmentation are going to occur over the next century. Now, this is a very familiar topic. We learn this in 101 ecology, that humans are fragmenting the landscape, and that this is a major driver of biodiversity change. But you'll be surprised to realize that actually there is some controversy within the literature and within the field about whether fragmentation has any effect at all, and whether to a first order approximation, it's all just habitat loss. So let me spend a few seconds just reminding you what habitat fragmentation is. I mean, here's a nice example of forest cutting in Brazil, in the state of Rondônia, and you can see over a period from 1975 on the left here through 1989 to 2001 how we get this sort of fishbone effect as human beings go in through roads and entry points into the forest. They slowly destroy the habitat, and they create a fragmented system. All right? And this pattern, whether you look today in central Brazil or whether you're looking in the change in forest cover in Montreal over the last 300 years, the story is the same. Right? We never completely destroy a habitat. We always fragment it. And the process takes a long, long time. We live in a region that's extremely fragmented. The Monte Regi has, in many parts of it, far less than 30% forest cover. And in some cases, we're down to the 15 to 12% of forest cover. We're situated right here. This is a landscape that many of us work in, are familiar with, but there was very rapid deforestation and fragmentation. So why should we worry about fragmentation? Maybe everybody's right. Maybe we should just worry about how much loss, what percentage of forest was lost. Well, it's a fairly complicated process, and biodiversity responds to fragmentation in a dynamic way. So if you look here, this is some cartoon of how we might fragment this blob of forest. We could cut half of it down, and it would still remain a continuous patch. But we could also keep a similar proportion of forest or of habitat, but change the distribution of those habitat elements in the landscape. And when we do that, we do a bunch of things. We create a process of change, which amounts to, yes, a loss of total area, but also we get this highly nonlinear increase in the number of small fragments. We increase the edge to interior ratio of the fragments, so we increase the importance of edge effects. And we also increase the isolation between habitats. We disrupt the connectivity or the continuity of our landscapes. And we've understood this for a long time. We get this. Okay. The question is now, you have to imagine Darwin's tangled bank living and inhabiting this fragmented area. And how does it change? How does it respond to that? Well, here is one particular view. Chopping down all of the trees gives you a clear view of the devastation caused by chopping down all of the trees. So, you know, we get this notion that it's just mass destruction and there is nothing left to see and there is no tangled bank. Well, obviously this is an amusing simplification of how destruction works and how fragmentation works. And the case should be signed, sealed, and closed. We should know how biodiversity responds to fragmentation. We've been working on it for the best part of 50 years. And yet right now we're in the middle of a controversy. We're in what some people are calling the fragmentation paradox. The paradox being that fragmentation has become a reified doctrine. What is a reified doctrine? Well, down here is a little definition because I had to look it up on Wikipedia. Reification is a fallacy of treating an abstraction as if it were a real thing. So we've been treating fragmentation as this simplified abstraction of how we change nature, and yet have provided no evidence, according to Jacobi et al., that this matters. So Jacobi et al. Is also co-signed by Michael Rosenzweig, one of the most influential people in ecology who's written about restoration ecology and reconciliation ecology. He doesn't believe that fragmentation matters. He thinks it's peanuts, trivial for biodiversity. So what I'm going to do in this talk is hopefully convince you that it's not a reified doctrine, that there's no reification going on here, and that we do need to worry about habitat fragmentation. So I'm going to take a bit of a sort of a historical perspective, the kinds of results we've accumulated in our lab, and some of it will be sort of the classics of the work we've done in our lab, and some of it's going to be much more recent. So I'm going to take you through the story in 20 minutes. So what's the gold standard? How do we tease apart the relative contribution of fragmentation as opposed to everything else that goes on in a fragmented landscape? And the gold standard is to do experiments, right? To couple those experiments to good theory and to iterate that loop between theory and experiments. So a bunch of what we do is we take model systems. In particular, we've used this moss-based model system, so carpets of moss that contain many hundreds of species of wondrous complexity and amazing interactions that go on right under your feet when you're walking in the boreal forest. And we treat that as our mini tropical forest, right? Our mini mixed deciduous forest. And we fragment it. We impose fragmentation. We modify it. And we look at how biodiversity responds to that fragmentation to see if it's a good model for what we think is going on in real landscapes and to test theory with it. And we can do that simply on a rock in the middle of a forest, or we can go up to the boreal forest, and this is the work that John Whiteley's been involved in, and Zoe, looking at how climate change might interact with habitat fragmentation to change biodiversity. So what we do is we have this sort of classical design where we have an area that we keep unfragmented, an area where we fragment, and we modify particular parameters, you know, those four big parameters that we thought about for fragmentation earlier on, and we see how that affects biodiversity. Here are some of the wondrous beasts, a fraction of the wondrous beasts that live in our bryosphere that we respond and we measure. And these guys have all sorts of interesting life history characteristics and amazing processes, amazing functional roles in the bryosphere. So what we did in this experiment was we set up a fragmentation. We looked to see if there was any evidence that fragmentation has any effect on the biodiversity. Okay? And what we did is we fragmented these islands and we tracked them for a year, and we looked at the changes in mean species richness per fragment. And this is what you see over time. So over the course of a year, we compared the mean species richness in a fragment and in the same sized area that was in the continuous patch of moss. And what you'll notice was that initially, after fragmentation, there was no difference. There was no effect of fragmentation. We had the same mean species richness in a fragment as in a control. And then after about 6 months, something happened. The system diverged, and we had a delayed response. We got the extinction of almost 40% of the species in this system by the end of the experiment. Not only that, but those species that were remaining in the system also were declining dramatically. So what you see here is a figure after 6 months and 12 months of fragmentation. This is the species abundance. So each dot is a species. So you can see there are about 20, 30 species that we were looking at. This is their abundance in the continuous habitat on this axis, and this was their abundance after fragmentation. So any dots on the one-to-one line tells you there was no change in abundance. You'll notice that by 12 months, almost all the dots had dropped below the one-to-one line. That means that not only was extinction going on, but those that were persisting were declining. And you'll notice that this is on a log scale. So there were dramatic orders of magnitude changes in abundance. So population declines were widespread. Think back to that global map I was showing you about global mean species population declines. But that cuts a long story short, but basically that's just looking at fragmentation, and I found lots of evidence that fragmentation matters. But what about connectivity? What about restoring what we were arguing to be important? So my approach here was to take what we call landscape modules. These are small groups of habitat elements that are repeated throughout the landscape, and to consider those as our minimum unit of complexity. And in this instance, this would be four patches connected by corridors. So when we looked at that, and we fragmented our mossy landscapes, our Lilliputian landscapes of moss, and we looked to see the role of the corridors, what you'll see is that corridors actually slow biodiversity loss. We compared an intact habitat with four fragments that were connected by corridors and four fragments that were connected by broken corridors. And you'll notice that the important treatment comparison here is between the corridor and the broken corridor. The only difference in geometry between those landscape modules was a tiny break in the corridors. And you'll see there was a huge influence of the continuity, or the disruption of connectivity in these landscapes. So this is the first evidence at the time that corridors could actually slow extinction. So I was convinced that corridors were going to be an important conservation strategy. But of course, it takes, you know, this is a very simple approach. We're just looking at mean species richness. What about our much more influential, potentially important idea about the effects on species that are persisting in those landscapes? So here, it's the same type of figure. Anything on the one-to-one line is showing no change or no impact of fragmentation. And you'll notice that the orange dots are those species that are persisting in the discontinuous or fragmented landscapes, and they were all way below the one-to-one line. So we have massive population declines, widespread. And those that are inhabiting connected landscapes, inhabiting corridored landscapes, you'll see that the decline was much less significant, that on average there was ready to be minor or modest changes in abundance. Since then, more recent work that we've been doing, Graham Bell and I have been working on, is trying to figure out what will be the consequences of these changes in population. And we've come to learn that if you reduce population sizes roughly the orders of magnitude that you see here, you have a massive impact on the capacity of populations to adapt to local environmental change. So there are evolutionary consequences of this change to the tangle bank, which would make Darren happy. Maybe not happy, but he would be nodding wisely at this point. But so what? Okay, it's biodiversity. There's lots of biodiversity. There are millions of species on the planet. Who cares? Well, some people have started, the last 15 years have seen a body of research that have tried to tie or link biodiversity change to ecosystem function. All right, 15, 20 years of research where people like Dave Tillman at Cedar Creek have sown whole fields with gradients of species richness and tried to see how manipulating species richness would affect the functioning of those ecosystems. And we can hypothesize different types of relationships for how declining biodiversity, going from right to left on this axis, would lead to either catastrophic declines or proportional declines or slow declines in ecosystem function. But a big weakness of this field is that they're not representing trajectories of species loss as you would expect in fragmented landscapes. These are randomized biodiversity gradients. Even despite that, this field is still showing that there are massive effects of biodiversity change. In general, most of the studies, when we do a meta-analysis, 80 to 90% of the studies suggest that we get slow effects initially, weak effects of biodiversity change on function, but then it's catastrophic at the end, and we get these sort of tipping points, if you like, or nonlinear relationships between biodiversity and some measure of function. So how is this story modified by thinking about how biodiversity and function is linked in fragmented landscapes? So we did that. We studied this problem. We brought our biosphere into the lab, and we studied how modifying the connectivity of the landscape affected the functioning of those landscapes. We don't know anything about this. Our focus has been on biodiversity. So what happened in this system? Well, I'm going to cut a long story rather short. Here is a summary of what happened. So we've got four lines here that show us one measure of functioning in our ecosystem. It's the cumulative total nitrogen that's leached out of our ecosystem. So it's potentially available to the inhabitants of our biosphere. And each line represents a different landscape. So the black line represents the continuous landscapes. The blue line represent the connected landscapes, and the green and the orange represent our fragmented landscapes. So we're looking for deviations in the trajectories over the time course of our experiment according to our fragmentation treatments. And so you see initially the three fragmented systems, right, everything that's not continuous, diverge, and they start accumulating nitrogen. They start stocking and holding nitrogen in the system, whereas the continuous system, the black line, is basically at equilibrium. And then from day 150 on, we saw something amazing happen. We saw a sort of a recovery. We saw that those systems that were connected with corridors started to diverge from the discontinuous systems. And that they were starting to approach, at least they were a halfway house, between the continuous system and the fragmented systems. So corridors have the potential at least to mediate, modify, and buffer the impact of fragmentation on the end cycle, on the nitrogen cycle, which is an important component of fertility in many ecosystems, but especially in this system where we have decomposition going on. So the reason for that process is fairly complicated, but it leads us to think about more about the realities of the complexity of the tangled bank. It wasn't just a simple story of, oh, biodiversity was decaying, therefore nitrogen was being stocked in the system and it was inaccessible. No. What was happening was that we were getting extinction that was happening in priority at the top of the food chain, at the top of the food web. We were losing predators at the top. And by losing predators, here is our simple representation of this trophic system, in the fragmented habitat, we had far fewer predators. What that meant was that the predators were not controlling the grazers, and the grazers were locking up and were stocking all the nitrogen that was in the system. Normally, the predators allow us to return that nitrogen back into the available pool. So here you see straight away that we're linking the cause, the disruption of connectivity in our system, to changes in the strophic structure, we're then having lasting consequences for the nitrogen cycle. So that was sort of a whirlwind tour through, I hope, you know, a clean experiment, a set of experiments that should be building a case that, you know, lead us to believe that fragmentation is important. We've controlled habitat loss, we've controlled fragmentation, and we've played with connectivity, often in quite subtle ways, and we're seeing big effects. So here are four reasons, in my opinion, why we still need to worry about fragmentation. Fragmentation causes widespread population declines. These may be delayed and non-random and may hinder the probability of local adaptation. Isolation precludes the rescue effects due to immigration because we're breaking the landscape. And edge effects degrade habitat quality. So if we don't allow for a sufficient ratio between edge to interior, even the species that are persisting are going to decline dramatically. And finally, although I haven't shown the evidence for that today, habitat fragmentation actually makes extinction thresholds worse. They steepen the tipping points. They bring those tipping points closer to us in the future. So we need to worry about that. Fragmentation is a real issue, I would argue, but there are other consequences at the regional level. So I want to consider, move away from the perception of thinking about what's going on in a local patch to thinking about what's going to happen in a region that's fragmented. So remember that image of the Monte Regi that I showed you? We're dealing with a highly fragmented system. Over the next 50 to 100 years, we're going to have to work to restore connectivity in that system. Why should we do that other than just restoring biodiversity? Well, by doing that, we get a lot of other things that come along for free. We get something that's described by what we call the spatial insurance hypothesis, that by maintaining biodiversity across a landscape, what we do is not only do we not maximize or optimize, but increase the supply of services or the supply of functions that ecosystems provide, but we also buffer the variability in those ecosystems. And so we created a very simplified form. This is work with Michel Leroy and Nicolas Mouquet. We created a very simplified representation of a patchy landscape, a fragmented landscape, in which dispersal was the driving variable. And what we do is when we turn the parameter, the dispersal parameter, and we play with the connectivity in that landscape, we can go from a landscape that's stable, biodiverse, and productive, to one that's highly unstable, highly unresilient, much less productivity. So that's an interesting hypothesis. It's a good argument for restoring connectivity, but does it matter? What would we expect to happen in a real landscape? We don't know. We haven't gone beyond moss landscapes and some couple differential equations. We need to do the work at the landscape scale to see if this hypothesis, this spatial hypothesis, can be the foundation for restoration and, in particular, for restoring connectivity. Because it's a strong argument. And here is a cartoon of that argument again. So imagine a landscape at the bottom left here, right? The green represents lush, mixed, deciduous forest, lots of biodiversity and birds. And then, you know, there is some urban environment, urban land use. And what we'd expect at intermediate levels of habitat destruction is a functional landscape. All right? We've got a lot of biodiversity, which we could decompose into its local alpha components of biodiversity and the beta components of diversity, right? The distinctness of the diversity across space in different communities. And according to our spatial insurance hypothesis, we would expect this system to be stable through time, that it would recover from disturbance, and that we'd have a good functioning relationship between biodiversity and function. But what happens if we fragment that landscape? What happens if we destroy further habitat through land use and through urbanization? Well, the model tells us that we will lose biodiversity, but we will lose not only gamma diversity, the total pool of species in the region, but we're diminishing that beta diversity, that distinctness of communities. We're homogenizing our system. We're making it less capable of recovering from disturbance. And in these models, we might even expect some sort of flip to an unstable state, something that is much more variable, much less predictable through time and across space. So we're working on this problem now. We're trying to figure out whether the spatial insurance hypothesis holds water, whether we can, it's something we can even work towards at the landscape scale. But I've now invested a lot of effort into thinking about how we might use this to restore connectivity in landscapes and to go to policymakers and to managers and to use this framework to help them understand why it's important to have a regional plan. So why it's important to think about how you connect corridors at the scale of a region and not just between two patches at a very, very local scale. And right now, we are not doing that. We're not doing regional planning. We're not trying to restore connectivity in a way that makes sense to maintain biodiversity and ecosystem function. So the way we're working on this in our lab is we've sort of tied ourselves to this idea of regional ecological networks. This is the idea. This is a map for the Monte Regi, the eastern part of the Monte Regi. So these are the townships. Here you see the Monte Region Hills, San Bruno, Mont-Saint-Hilaire, Rougemont, Yamaska, etc., as we go from west to east. This is a pilot analysis. But what we're seeing is we're trying to understand what would it take to reconnect this landscape so that it became functional, so that it could become resilient. How many millions of trees would we have to plant to reconnect this landscape? We don't know the answer to that, but we need to have a plan and we need to optimize the design of connectivity at this scale. The MUST experiments tell us that. The theory tells us that. Now we have to have research that brings on the transformations in our understanding of spatial modeling and GIS and remote sensing to make this work. How would we do it? Well, in a landscape that's so heavily torn apart by highways, by urban areas, we're going to have to be creative. We're going to have to be creative engineers. People have started doing this in the west of the country. We're going to have to start building wildlife bridges. We're going to have to start allowing connectivity. Not only connectivity at the short spatial scale, not so that a white-tailed deer can go from one fragment to another fragment, but to foster species that want to move under climate change from the south to the north, to allow species to colonize new environments, not to do the colonization for them. So we need to be thinking about these bridges, not because we want to save the charismatic megafauna, but because we need to restore connectivity across the hierarchy of life, across the tangled bank. So I'm going to make a few conclusions based on this. What I've told you today. There is no reification here. It's a useful abstraction, but it's an abstraction that's backed up with data. It's backed up by experiments. It's backed up by field data from all over the world. The field and the literature on habitat fragmentation is enormous. I've done absolutely no justice to it today. I could give the entire talk with other people's work, and it would be full of interesting new dimensions. Habitat fragmentation is a major cause of biodiversity loss. You cannot just think about how much habitat you destroy. The gains or the extra losses that you get due to just the configuration of habitat in the landscape could be as much as another 40%. There are, of course, interactions with other drivers, and we have to worry about that over the next century. So we've shown evidence for delayed non-random extinction sequences. These are things that are going to hit us in the future. We have to account for them now, but we know they're coming. We see profound modifications of food webs and ecosystem function and stability. And I firmly believe that one way we can deal with this whilst, having a reasonable, sustainable use of landscapes is perhaps the strategy of ecological networks. They will allow us to restore biodiversity and ecosystem services while ensuring resilient landscapes under climate change. This work wouldn't have been possible without a lot of people. I can't thank them all. There are some names up here, everyone in the Gonzalez lab, for giving me energy, for keeping me going, and for all the insight and creativity that you give and you share with everyone else in the lab. The QCBS team who make the QCBS possible and to spread the biodiversity science word throughout the province. And then Elena, Jeff, Marty, Janine have been important in my thinking over the last six months to a year. And, of course, Virginie and Martin. And thanks to the money people. Thanks, folks.
Are there any questions for Andy?
Yes, there are.
Hi. I think there is a problem of reification that needs to be considered here. For example, in our society, we have tend to reify this idea of democracy, and we tend to think of it as a system that is sufficient in and of itself to guarantee an optimized outcome, which is, at this point, clearly ridiculous. We've reified the economy or the invisible hand as a mechanism that guarantees the best of all possible worlds, right? As sort of a if you're going to try to implement these solutions that you're alluding to, how do you get around these other problems of reification?
I would say through active engagement with stakeholders, with people for whom these decisions are going to count. We have this sort of academic reification of concepts, right? This sort of top-down ivory tower imposition of how the world should be. And maybe I'm going to say that's how the world should be. You need to reconnect the Montérégie, but it's meaningless if it's not goes beyond the abstraction, right? Becomes real and on the ground. So my first point, I'd say, not only do we need to communicate better as scientists, but we actually need to go and engage and explain why the science lead you to that conclusion, and then make it, and by doing that, you make it less abstract, more practical, and more operational. That sort of partially answers your question. Yeah, I mean, democracy, you know, I'm not sure how much people are involved in democracy, right? So there's a paradox there as well. And I think that we can avoid that by, in a way I've just alluded to.
Is the benefit of corridors a binary effect, or does their like, length or width or anything like that matter?
Oh, absolutely. And to be honest, we don't really know. The problem with ecological networks is that you're trying to design them so they work for butterflies, deer, birds, and every organism perceives its landscape differently. There's a functional connectivity issue. So how do you design a network that works for everything? So what you have to envisage is something that's multi-scale. So you have micro linkages versus broad-scale linkages. And in that way, I hope we can foster connectivity across body sizes and across groups. But yes, we need more work on those kinds of key issues.
Really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of functional components of
yes.
richness and diversity.
Yes.
So you're showing this relationship between increased fragmentation and a decline in biodiversity, but certainly within that decline, there's some sort of a functional component where certain species contribute more to the decline in function of that sort of new system. What is your sense if you're trying to restore those systems and how you would approach putting those functional groups back or those sort of key components?
Goodness, that's a great question. There are a subset of organisms that do a lot just by moving. They transport seeds, they transport pollen, they transport resources. And by doing that, they connect the landscape, but functionally connect the landscape. You think of a pollinator, right? So we can restore the functional component that's due to connectivity most easily by working on corridors. And we need to do that. But that's not, you know, there are keystone species and there are concepts like mobile link species and these other things that we have a very poor handle on that do a good job just, you know, without moving, just in situ. And so we have to have this at least two-dimensional notion of function in situ and function as a connecting process. We observe that in this system. Some organisms do a lot by grazing locally. They move on, they graze locally, and they stimulate decomposition that way. So the Calembula in our moss system move a lot. They integrate across space. So I would focus on those if my strategy is to reconnect the functional component.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
Do you consider habitat fragmentation to be an even greater danger than outright habitat destruction, as in chopping down the trees and so on?
So I might have given, given the impression that I think that habitat loss is not important. Obviously, it's extremely important. And in the limit, it's everything. You know, if you set everything to zero, then, okay, there's no more biodiversity. You know, there's no specialist species left from that habitat. But we rarely reduce any landscape to 0% habitat. You see the Monte Regi is an incredibly fertile lowlands, massive production of agriculture. We still have 20 to 30% forest there. So the question is that configuration optimal? Can we manage that fragmentation better? So I would say that if that general pattern is true, if in general we tend to fragment rather than wholesale destroy, let's be clever about how we destroy. Let's do it in a meaningful way that maintains the resilience of our ecosystems and maintains biodiversity.
We have time for one last
how convenient.
Quick question.
Very, very, very well done, Tony. Andy, I wanted to ask you a question. You used the phrase landscape module.
Yes.
Which caused me to think a little bit differently about habitat and fragmentation. Because when we think of habitats, we think of a habitat.
That's right.
A type of forest or whatever with an edge around it.
Yes.
But the concept of landscape module, or the term that you use, made me start thinking more about a module of landscape that might integrate multiple habitats. And I wondered whether some of the questions about habitat fragmentation and biodiversity actually look at this that idea of a landscape module?
They do. So it's not, I didn't invent that notion. I think it goes back to people like Foreman. People, landscape ecologists, have thought about what is the minimum atom? What's the, you know, what's the atom in a landscape? So there are sort of these repeatable elements. But and it's essential to think of that atom as a multi-habitat thing, because, you know, it's a spatial process and we need habitat heterogeneity to have a functional landscape. The idea hasn't been taken further. In food web literature, we think about food web modules all the time. We think about these diamond, you know, keystone predators, and that's how we build an understanding of a complex system like a food web. I would argue that we need to do more of that in the landscape and in the fragmentation literature, not only because it's interesting from a fundamental science point of view and whether we need to test it as a hypothesis, but also it's the logical way to go about managing and adapting, to go about thinking about them as units of habitat, groups of habitat. I don't think that answers your question. How could I answer that better?
I actually thought you did a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Andy.
Thanks.